Tonight I will read from the Ajahn Sumedho Anthology, Volume 5, The Real Truth, and the talk is titled Trusting in Wholesome Intentions. When someone becomes a bhikkhu, the ceremony states that it's in order to realize nibbana and be free from all suffering. It conveys that intention, and you might think, how dare I make such an intention? It's too great, it's too grand, it's too high for me. That's your ego talking. Recognize this and learn how to use your rational mind as a guide so that by making the intention in a very deliberate and rational way, it sets the tone of your life and helps you make your life worthy. It also reflects your feeling of unworthiness or inability to use an opinion, doubts, and despair. All the valleys of despair and boredom and disillusionment that you have to go through. But having made this perfect intention, if we put our trust in this intention, we're no longer attaching to this tendency to doubt. When this deliberate, cool intention is established in your mind, trust it. Put your faith in that perfect intention, make it a guiding star. However, be careful you don't fall off the edge of a cliff because you're looking at the star too much. You can't see where you are exactly or what dangers are right in front of you. You need the star as a direction. It's high, it's beautiful, and so you move in that direction. But you're also taking into account where you are now in terms of obstruction and difficulties. Trust yourself. You're the conscious being that's experiencing life. Learn to trust your own ability to observe and learn from what you do. We don't always do everything the right way, but we learn from our mistakes. That's wisdom. Wisdom doesn't mean you're going to do everything right and all your decisions are to be incredibly wise. That's not the way we learn. We often learn by taking risks and sometimes making a mess of everything before we can do it right. But the willingness to learn, that's the important thing. It's like setting out on a journey and finding yourself going around in circles before you're going in the right direction. If you've already been established in your goal, you have that guiding star, and you can begin to see what you're doing and go in the right direction again. And trusting yourself, you're not trusting your ego or your opinions with an inflated kind of belief in everything you think or feel. Thoughts and emotions are conditioning the mind arising out of ignorance, not understanding the Dhamma. The thinking process is a habitual flow of proliferating thoughts and reactions to things. My opinions and views and feelings about this person or that thing. So I never regard the thinking process as something to trust, but I do trust my ability to pay attention. I'm willing to put forth the effort to learn from life through mindfulness and trust my ability to listen, wait, and be patient. In this kind of awareness, we're getting beyond the momentum of our habits, the traps of mind, and our cultural conditioning. Living in Thailand as a foreigner is a very different culture, for example, and it helped me reflect on my Western conditioning. Then living here in England helped me reflect on my American conditioning, the whole set of assumptions that comes from your parents and society you live in. Even before you can read and write, you start picking up all these cues about who you are, what's important, and what life should be like, how you should act, and how you should think. This is the cultural conditioning process. With mindfulness, we begin to see beyond this. We begin to notice the way we tend to react to things and the assumptions we have about ourselves and others in the world we live in. When I first went to live in Thailand, I was very critical of American ways. I love Thailand, I love the people and the culture, and I was very patronizing about Thailand being much better and nicer than the West. I was generally making a big thing about how a wonderful place Thailand was. Of course, it was difficult at first. The monastic life in Thailand is highly developed in morality and discipline, and quite different from American ideals of freedom and individuality. You have your duties assigned according to the hierarchical structure. This is difficult for an American because we're brought up to think in terms of equality. Egalitarianism is the best way and hierarchies are not appropriate. I had to adjust my feelings and my emotional reactions to living in this kind of hierarchical structure. I was junior, at the end of the line. I was a foreigner. I was also taller than all the other monks. Everybody noticed me. They'd always say, Prathran. Every afternoon, the monks had to go out and draw water from the well and old kerosene tins and pulleys, and then carry these containers of water around the bamboo pole held between two monks. All this was very primitive, and I was quite entranced by it at first, because it was new. But I could see my American mind thinking of ways to improve the system. In America, we do it better. Too much time spent on laborious tasks, and I'd rather be singing my kuti and samadhi than having to draw water from a well. It took me quite a while to see the teaching was to reflect on the way you're feeling. I began to notice my opinionated views and a lot of conceit that I didn't think I had, an underlying tendency in the cultural conditioning process I acquired in the West. How to work with this, how to use the situation with mindfulness and wisdom is quite a challenge. When are egalitarian equality appropriate, and when is hierarchical structure appropriate? When is it useful, and when is it counterproductive? This you can't just conclude from opinions, but through noticing and through trial and error, trying to learn from experience. It's not a matter of saying this is right and that's wrong. Begin to reflect on how to use these things in the right way. When I first came to England, I was so much part of the Thai conditioning and Thai monastic life. Even though I'm egalitarian culturally, my monastic life has been very much an intense training within a hierarchical structure. So it was interesting how at first I felt threatened in England by having to deal with so many things I couldn't control. Living in Thailand as a monk was just part of a whole cultural attitude where you just knew your place. You knew what to do, and everybody knew what they had to do. They knew what was right and what was wrong, giving you a tremendous sense of security and a sense of safety. The first 2 years in London, I was never quite sure what to do and how far to go, how I should adapt or how I should change. I wasn't sure when I was getting intimidated or if the hierarchical structure was being useful. I didn't know what was wise or what was holding on to old traditions or how it was how was it adapting in a wise way. Should one go all the way or halfway? All these kinds of feelings and thoughts, I had to take it day by day, hoping it would be all right. I just didn't know. Nobody knew how to survive as a Buddhist monk in England. What to do then? There were a lot of opinions. You can't wear robes in London. You can't go on alms round. English people don't like bowing. Don't ask them to. They won't like chanting. They won't like ceremonies. However, as it turned out, life in Hampstead Vihar was very different from what I expected. There wasn't really any problem about bowing or ceremonies or chanting. In fact, people wanted them. At first, we decided not even to do chanting. And people asked, why don't you chant? Teach us to bow. So it wasn't us forcing our customs on them. It was people taking an interest and wanting to know what to do in that kind of situation. Ajahn Chah was also criticized by some Thai people who said, you know, you're teaching meditation to these foreigners and they don't even have good sila yet. They're not even moral, and yet you're teaching samadhi. First you got to establish samadhi, first you got to establish sila, then you get good sila, and then you can go into samadhi and panya. That's how it's usually written in scriptures, sila, samadhi, panya. Ajahn Chah's answer to that was quite marvelous. He said, look, you got to start where people come from, you got to start from what people are interested in. These people don't come here for sila, they come here for samadhi. So you start teaching them samadhi, and eventually they get around to sila. It's not like you can have one without the other, but he said, you got to know what people are interested in, what they're inspired by, what they have faith in. Through that, you can communicate, you can reach them, and eventually you'll get the sila and see the necessity of more responsibility. Trust in the ability to learn from trial and error, learn from taking risks and seeing what works, and from letting go of your own fears, opinions, and prejudices in order to be more open to the experience. All the stereotypes that are usually part of one's cultural conditioning, let go of them and learn how to trust in the ability to pay attention to life in the present. Learn to incorporate the good things and develop and encourage the goodness within this culture, so that the monastic tradition is a force within society, not seen as a device of alienating cult. Learn how to be a Buddhist monk within a society that's mostly not Buddhist. Don't get caught trying to convert or criticize and cause more divisions within the religions in this country. In ways like this, you're beginning to trust your capacity to learn from this ability to pay attention and observe. It's more intuitive. It's not a rational approach. It's not based on any views you might have as to what British people are like and what they need and what they don't like. What we're doing is opening up on this intuitive level where we're aware of the forces around us, what we're feeling, and the way things are. If we trust more and surrender into that intuitive attentiveness to the present, then we tend to respond in more skillful ways than we do if we're caught up in habitual reactions to experience. Habitual reactivity means you're conditioning to react in certain ways. It's like pushing the buttons. Push this button, you get that reaction. This happens and we react. We can live our lives just by reacting to things, and such reactions just reinforce reactive habits. In this practice, you're using the awakened state, the one who's aware. So you're listening. You're putting yourself in the state of attentive awareness where intuition operates, where there's wisdom, where you begin to tune into the ultimate reality, The doors of the deathless are open. This is not clearly defined in terms of thoughts or ideas. So you have to trust and have faith, because you're trying to figure it out and you're going back to following your reactions, the conditioning of the mind. So you tend to see through the filters of your own opinions, views, prejudices, and biases. When you stop doing that, you begin to understand things through intuition, through wisdom. You tend to respond more appropriately to experience. The important thing is working with your own mind, keeping in the state of awareness, and keeping from going into speculation as you're dealing with things that you have to deal with. Monasteries, temples, monks, nuns, lay people, whatever it is you're experiencing. The strength of the practice is in the mind. It's not dependent on external conditions. One can respond to external conditions from that still place within, rather than just react. You can then avoid getting confused or fed up because you can't control the external world to fit your ideals of how things should be. I've always wanted to be a hermit, to get out of the whole thing by living in a cave and not have to be in a state where there are many demands. Something in me doesn't want to take risks. It wants to be in a certain place where things are for sure. It wants to live in a place where everything is fixed, a place where you know exactly what's right and what's wrong, what you should do and what you should not do. There's something in me that would feel very secure in that situation. But then, because I've had to live here for over 20 years, I've developed my trust in myself and practice meditation. This means I can be of use, of service, and a good influence in this country without being weakened by any difficulties. In fact, it's been my strengthening. I've gained strength from having to work with my mind, confusing, disappointing, and difficult situations. This was one of the guests given at Amarvati in 1997. I also want to read some few answers you gave in an interview or conversation. I think it's related. He was talking with in a conversation with Jack Kornfield, and one of the questions was, out in Sumedha, you and Jack are both trained in Asia, and now you've established these huge centers, one monastic and one lay. But when you teach, do you find yourself drawing on what you learn from the teachers in Asia, or do you find that you have to alter it for Western minds? Is there some way in which your teaching is fundamentally different from how you learn? Ajahn Sumedha answers, while I was with Ajahn Chah, I also had to adapt. I had to adapt them because of the cultural differences, the emphasis, and even the Thai speech patterns. If you took them literally in English, they were too hard and they make you feel very compulsive. Question, for example, Ajahn Sumedha, well, in Thailand, they talk about killing the kilesas, which is a reference to getting rid of your defilements. Before I ever meditated, I've been trying to do that and found it just led to repression. But Ajahn Chah's teaching encouraged us to develop a pious, skillful means that work for us. He really liked us to work out our own skillful means according to our own particular characters, never insisting that we do it this way. When I told him that killing defilements didn't help me very much, he agreed, because it's really about just being mindful and letting them be. Ajahn Chah had to slow the Westerners down because we were really socket to them in the beginning. But over the years, out of necessity, I adapted to situations I found myself in, yet I've always felt very much in the spirit of Ajahn Chah. And there's one other question. There's a kind of question that the interviewer asked if you had any other things you wanted to say more about Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Sumedha answered, surprised me how famous he became, because he was in a rather remote and least attractive part of Thailand, but it was just the way he taught and his effect on both Thais and Westerners. It was because of Westerners and the difficulties created by them not speaking Thai in a monastery where there were Thai monks that gave Ajahn Chah the idea to establish Wat Phananachat as a special place to train Westerners. Since I was the most senior of the monks, I would be the head monk. At first, I wasn't keen on this, but because I decided to help, I determined to do it, and it worked. Wat Phananachat is now highly regarded in Thailand, and Western people from all over the world go there to train. But that was his vision of things. Ajahn Chah taught the purpose and meaning of monastic life. It was through him that I saw the whole monastic package come together, the life of awareness and contentment, the emphasis on community, sangha, and helping each other. This was very much part of a practice, such as not having a water pump on relying on somebody else to help when we needed to draw water from the well. And I found this quite revealing, because I brought up I was brought up in the opposite way, to be independent and not having to bother somebody else just to get some water. That's how I thought culturally. I like the convenience of when I need water, I can go get it and I'm not bothering anybody. But his attitude was to be very interdependent. This brought up a lot of mental states in me because it was going against my very strong American conditioning of I don't need you, I can do it all by myself and do it my own way.
Could I ask you a similar question? I mean, how much translation or how much did you have to adapt Ajahn Chah's way of training or, to yourself?
I don't know. It's an ongoing translation, really. A lot of it is trying to see what works, what's helpful. Living with Ajahn Chah over a long period of time, being able to witness the different ways that he, because he didn't have a template. he didn't have a template for this is the Ajahn Chah meditation style, this is the way you should be, this is the way you have to think. It was really, of course he had quite solid principles, but he recognized that there were different temperaments, different people. People needed things at different times. So sometimes he could be quite kind and gentle, and other times he'd really push you. So that, and sometimes I'd be with the same person, sometimes it'd be I certainly felt that where sometimes he was really solicitous of me, and other times he just really push me. So that a lot of it is just okay, what works. So I think certainly the Ajahn Chah's example of selflessness, very important, trying to maintain that flavor trying to hold that, and how do you adapt things so that you facilitate that? Your commitment to mindfulness and reflection and investigation. Those are things that trying to implement that. I mean, those are solid core of Ajahn Chah's teaching and the example. As well as the incredible integrity that we have. Right? So trying to hold that, those principles. How does it translate? How does it work? A lot of it is just when you have a gut feeling for it, just like a gentle wind, certainly intuition. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But then you have to do it after again.
So that kind of sounds just like your teaching style. I always come back and say that I highly praise mindfulness of the breath.
Right.
And did Ajahn Chah have a statement like that? I'm very open, but this is the one thing that he encouraged.
Whenever he gave, but when I say I hear you praise it, it's sort of like that's what's worked for me, and I can't sort of give a lot of I dabble with just about everything, just sort of seeing, but like in terms of where my kind of core practice is and what that's, so I have to speak from my experience. Mm-hmm. Other people have to figure out what their core practice is. But Ajahn Chah always would come back to the breath. Not as detailed as, say, the Nikon Sati Sutta, I can't rely on. But he had a very different experience and skill. It was Ajahn Beer who was. He's assumed to have psychic powers and know the minds of others. And said, you know, Ajahn Chah, he would sit down and pay attention to the breath. By the time he'd start paying attention to the in breath, by the time he was on the out breath, he was already in jhana. So. he didn't teach a whole lot of heat. Now, I think it was really curious to him that we wanted so much instruction. what's the big deal? That's all you have to do is just pay attention to your breath. And the mind goes silent. But his would fall in the first once, and he really, that's what he used to teach a lot.
Yeah. I find Ajahn Sumedho's statement about how he more or less for most of his adult life went straight against his personal tendencies really inspired. I mean, he could, you know, his inclination was to be a hermit, and look what he did.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's anybody here who's a different comes to the whole life. That's a problem. If you could famous and have a following. Usually, you need those real quick. It's true, all these in my case. Look, was the main was he trusted Ajahn Chah. Gave himself to Ajahn Chah. Of course, he I'm going to go back and give myself to Ajahn Chah. That came after being at something like that, and he was so fed up with Westerners that he just left and went to. Well, it was the first attempt to have Westerners living in the same place, and it was up in Tonsac. It was interesting. And often too long being here. And he was there for many months, and it was kind of striking. Should be there.
When he left, he was in charge?
Pardon?
When he left, who was in charge of that Thompson effect?
Nobody. No, they all left.
All the Westerners left?
All the Westerners left, yeah. I mean, it was a time once there anyway, in the sense that there was a group of, I mean, it's about 1,000 acres of land. It's a hill. It's got caves and forest and open space. It's quite beautiful. One of Ajahn Chah's favorite places. And there's a huge sal on the top of the hill. It catches the breeze from everywhere. It's nice views from everywhere. But I think everybody ended up there. I mean, some. Everybody pretty much went back to Wapakong. goes a bit more.
Before you became abbot at Wat Ananda, you were practicing on your own, more or less, or at a more reclusive monastery. And how did you decide to leave Wat Papong? Did you feel you had enough instruction from Ajahn Chah, so you wanted to practice on your own?
Yeah. I mean, I'd had periods of solitude already, and I'd been on Tugong. Paul was talking about, I wasn't quite sure. He was thinking maybe he was going to go off somewhere. So then I decided, okay, I'll go off and go to this. Actually, there's another place that's, I think, 1,000 acres of forest land along the border of Laos. And another, Ajahn Chah, these two places that he really liked, two retreat places that he really had a soft spot for. So I went and stayed there. Spent a range of three. And I was, and Ajahn Chah went and stayed at something like that, to this place at this, the Nam, with the idea that he just get away from Wat Papong and look at the duties and see if he could look after his health. But then it was after that, at the very end of that range of retreat, that he decided to have the operation on his brain to relieve the pressure on his brain, that's built up of fluid in his brain.
And then you went back to Wat Ananda Shah to practice with Ajahn Sumedho, or when that was formed? Did you go back then from that center when Wat Ananda Shah was formed to practice as a monk, and then you became, then you left again and became abbot?
Wat Ananda Shah was established in my second year as a monk.
Okay, so you were practicing there.
Yeah, so yes, I was at Wat Papong, and Wat Ananda Shah was established, and I stayed at Wat Papong. I didn't go to Wat Ananda Shah for many months. And then when I went over to Wat Ananda Shah I was working on a bowl stand, and I needed some help. So I went over to continue working on this bowl stand, get a bit more instruction on how to do it. Because my Thai wasn't good enough to understand some of the instructions. And then I got sick. Scrub typhus, and really ill, and was in hospital for a couple of weeks. So I went back, and I was just at the before the Ranger Street started, so I wasn't really strong enough to figure to be better to. Well, I wasn't even thinking of it. I just went back, came out of the hospital, went back to Wat Ananda Shah. It was a ranger tree, so I see. That was my second ranger tree. I came out of the hospital on the second. It's 115 pounds.
What were you before you went in?
Probably 145, something like that. Standard weight, probably lost me 30 pounds.
Did you stay at Wat Ananda Shah from then on, or did you go back and
forth? I went back and forth a lot before over the years. I went back and forth over the years. I spent quite a bit of time on but my main monasteries were Guatemala, and from time to time, from a short period, that had some of the French monasteries. But within the majority of my time, was Waterfall. Except when I went off on Tudor, and then I was just went off on my own for a year.
Were you on Tudong for a year?
A year, yeah.
Around Thailand?
I wasn't around so much as I realized what I liked to do was to stay in one place and practice on my own. So I would find places that maybe walk for a day or a couple of days and find a new place and stay for a month or 2 months and then stay for the main retreat for 4 months or so. So I didn't sort of getting toward the end of the year and I realized I haven't actually wandered much on Tudong. So then from where I spent the main retreat and it was on the western part of Thailand, along the Burmese border, walked along through the jungle areas where there were, sometimes there was, along the stretch that I went, it was like a 4 day walk with no villages.
So that means no food?
I had an olives with me.
You didn't eat the novice.
Yes, it was. Yeah, the novice was because the lay people were really concerned. They were going to send a whole group of people to look after me so I could go on funeral. And it was still kind of raining and wet, so I was staying at a mine site, which is now close by to where what's Mount Dalgan. It's a retreat place, very remote. So I took the owner of the mine up to Ubon to pay respects to Ajahn Chah. A good thing to do. And then we got there and there was this very restless novice in the monks said to do you want to take this novice on to the monastery? See you. So I said, yeah, sure. So he was out of Israel, he was Australian, and then the lay people showed him some of the vegetables in the forest that you could take, and so because he could carry some rice and some rice, pick some vegetables, eat very simply.
Some mushrooms,
that's amazing mushrooms. No, it wasn't mushroom. No. I wouldn't trust him with mushrooms. Northeast of Thailand, they're kind of bitter. Can't remember the name right now. They're very ordinary. It's like on a vine. Grew exactly the same way and looked exactly the same, but it was really, it was like real bitter and got poisoned. So.
how many glasses were you at this this period of time?
The year I went to Tibet was my sixth Lhasa. Finished my fifth Lhasa.
You basically discovered Tao in your sixth Lhasa?
Yeah.
That's when that started. Well,
yeah, although, see, what discovered it and stayed there for the Lhasa and got there, I don't know, possibly, almost be, it's probably in June or something, maybe. Because it was already, in those days, there was a lot more rain. Forests were way more extensive. And then I went and when Ajahn Chah was in England, it was his second trip, it was 1979. And so I went to pay respects to him and ask permission to spend the Lhasa on my own up in the forest. So when Rupa came back and I stayed with him and Joseph Campbell, the walker. And then he came back and then he gave his blessing for you. But that was sort of the outside mind. Where I spent the Lhasa. And it was 8 years after that, because I'd been here and there, and then I became abbot of one of the chapter. And after being abbot for a while, then I thought, it would be nice. You know, I just kept thinking it down. It would be a nice place to take the monks and introduce them to the real forest. So I contacted the owner, Yojana, and see if we could take the monks up there. And we did. And we did it for 7 years in a row, go up for a month or two. And but they were the mine where I spent the monks at. But the actual area where my kuti was that was still very dense. But the area outside had been logged and wasn't as the forest wasn't as because it had been commercially logged in the interim between when I was there for the Lhasa and when we came back. But the area inside wasn't, so we started going over there more. And they wanted us to set it down. And then Yom Suvan offered where Ajahn Koisabos monastery was. Have you ever been there?
The big one?
Yeah.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, she offered that land to me.
All right.
Yeah, I started that, and I thought, oh, it's good. Not my child, but doing this, doing that. Yeah. And I asked Ajahn Koisabos if he'd be interested. He was up here starting to look for a place. I said, you don't have to go looking. I've got a place for him. 15. Okay.